Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, Carl Roileson, a veteran author of more than 40 books, talks about his latest biography, Sylvia Plath, Day by Day, Volume 2. It was published by the University Press of Mississippi in August of this year. Carl was interviewed by fellow biographer and Bio member John, better known as Jack, Farrell.
Carl, this is a great honor for me to interview Dr. Biography, as he's known in the trade. This is a man who, as one critic said, reads biographies, he writes biographies, he writes about reading biographies, he writes about writing biographies. Writers are the subject of many of the biographies he reads and writes. Phew!
Yeah, exactly.
So this is definitely a life rich in biography. In reading one of the several books about biography that you've written, one thing jumped out at me was that you started out as an actor.
That's right.
So what is the connection between actor and a biographer?
I've thought about that a lot and didn't have a good answer until yesterday morning in the shower. And it took me 76 years to figure it out. Biography, as I write it, is a performance, just as when I taught. And many of my figures are what I might call performative personalities. And I'm very interested in how people project themselves in the world. It's sort of like what Shakespeare says, all the world is a stage, Hamlet says. What I figured out just the other day, one of the things that strikes me about biographers, and it's not exclusive to biographers, I think it's writers. When writers get together, they talk a lot about what an agony it is to write. How do you do this? How do you do that? And I always feel a little sheepish in saying, it's not like that for me. It's not that writing isn't hard, but I never think of it as a struggle. And what I finally came to realize is that each morning, and I usually write in the morning, and I face that page, it's not a blank space or pages some writers look at and are terrified by. For me, the page is a stage. It's almost beginning of a performance when I write. And that is so energizing to me that I write for about 2 hours, which would probably be the length of a play if I were in a play. And then I do other things the rest of the day, often related to biography. But generally, I don't write more than 2 hours a day.
Now we've solved the great mystery of what the line is that connects your subjects, which go from Marilyn Monroe, Lillian Hellman, Martha Gellhorn, Norman Mailer, Rebecca West, Susan Sontag, Sylvia Plath, Dana Andrews, Walter Brennan, and now William Faulkner, and others.
Up to
40 or 50 books, is that right?
Yes, that's right. I'm often asked, what is the connection between all these seemingly different figures? And I say, that's really an easy answer. The connection is me.
Okay.
But what I mean by that is that with most of my subjects, it's because I operate under the illusion that there's something about my subject that I know particularly well. And if the subject has been done before by other biographers, it's something I feel they missed that I feel uniquely prepared to write about. I call it an illusion because I have no idea if that's really true. I leave that to the readers of my books.
Yeah.
But that's another reason, I think, why I don't, in a sense, view writing as a struggle, because it's a kind of a mission.
Yeah.
I have detected something in the subject that so excites me, and that I read and I read and I read, and I see what other people say, and I say, that's not quite it.
And sometimes it's stunning in that for all the type and paper spent on Marilyn Monroe, you came up with an angle that made people say, whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was that she did have this great compulsion to work and to expand her craft in ways that were overlooked in Hollywood, but also by her biographer.
Yeah, it's true, yeah. And in fact, even my fellow biographers, the ones that came before me, saw that in my book and were of enormous help.
Yeah.
two of them in particular, Fred Giles and Marie Soloto, who had written biographies of her before. Nevertheless, when I wrote to them and began to explain what I was doing, they were almost as excited as I was.
So in reading your memoirs, I came across a fact that does not surprise me anymore, but may surprise the podcast listeners, except those who have heard me ask this question before, which is that a great number of well-known biographers, Ken Burns, Robert Caro, me, I wouldn't put myself in that category, but I just wanted to let the listeners know that I'm also talking from personal experience, lost a parent early in life.
Yeah.
And I've talked to Ken about this, and he says it's a compulsion to try to awaken the dead. It might be that what I'm engaged in, this is him talking, in a historical pursuit is a thin layer, perhaps thickly disguised waking of the dead that I try to make Abraham Lincoln and Jackie Robinson and Louis Armstrong come alive. And it may be very obvious and very close to home. What I'm actually trying to wake up is mother, which he lost when he was 11. I think that's a fascinating theme. And the two great classifications of people where I find it are politicians and biographers.
Oh, yeah.
Politicians just, they're just reaching out for the love that they lost when they were
as
a child. But what do you think?
I think there is a lot to that. I had not heard him say that. It makes me think about my own experience. I lost my father when I was 13, and he died rather gruesomely, which unfortunately I had to witness. And immediately, I had this sense of mortality. And I used to say to myself, try to get it done all by the age of 50. My father died at 51.
Uh-huh.
And then I passed 50 to my surprise, because I thought, and my mother died at 55, so I thought, I may not be that long for this world, so I better get it done. And then once I passed 50, I couldn't stop. I just couldn't stop. There is this connection, when I say, what connects all these subjects. It is me, and it's with Marilyn Monroe, for example. After my father died, about a year after my father died, that's when I got interested in acting. And there was this wonderful teacher at Nolan Junior High School in Detroit. He's still alive. He's almost 90. James Allen Jones. He performed Othello in England. He was very unusual. He was black. And there weren't very many African-American teachers in my junior high school. So he stood out. I never had him for a class, but I got interested in speech, and I'd won a speech contest, and a teacher said to me, why don't you see this fellow Jones? He's doing Shakespeare. At the time, I didn't know this, but he had done Shakespeare with 8-year-olds in England when he was performing Othello. And now he's doing it with junior high school students. And he gave me a script, a passage from Julius Caesar. And we were in this big auditorium in the front row. I was just sitting down and reading this script. And I read, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 lines, something like that. And he put his hand on my arm, and he looked at me, and he said, you read beautifully. Well, it changed my life. It did. It gave me a power and authority. And we've been in touch, ever since. He's really a surrogate father. So that's, what you see, it sets off a train of thought.
Yeah.
It's just...
So then what was the trigger? And or was there a moment when all of a sudden a light bulb went off and said, I am a biographer. I'm not an actor.
I was an academic. I got a PhD from the University of Toronto. I had done a dissertation on William Faulkner and got my PhD in 1975. And I was looking at the next generation of writers after Faulkner, and I got very interested in Norman Mailer and picked up his biography of Marilyn Monroe. It's a much maligned biography, I think, mistakenly. I think it's a wonderful book from a number of points of view. And he raised all kinds of questions about biography. How can you know someone else's life?
Mm-hmm.
And what is it about you? And of course, Mailer could do it because he had such a big personality. He says, put an artist on an artist. And that's the other wonderful thing, is he treated Marilyn Monroe as an artist, as an equal. People think, he treated her because, for the sex, goddess, and all that. That's in there. That's in the book. But so I wrote an article for the journal Biography in 1978. It was published in 78. It was a brand new journal at that point. And it was about Mailer's biography of Marilyn Monroe. And then shortly after that, I was approached by one of my former teachers to write not a biography of Marilyn Monroe, but for Greenwood Press, a bio-bibliography. And so I spent a summer reading what had been written about her and was disappointed, you know, saying, you know, I think I have something else here to offer. And so eventually I got rid of the Greenwood Press contract. And then I knew somebody from summer stock who knew Marilyn Monroe's masseur. And that just opened up all kinds of doors, frankly. Ralph Roberts, who was also an actor as well as a masseur. Once I started to talk to people about the person I was interested in, there was no looking back.
That was the light bulb going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned that line from Mailer, and that is a, you know, an impressionistic, expressionistic, stylistic adventure. There are others, and yet most biographies are written pretty tamely in the standard...
Pretty conventional.
Narrative and conventional. And I've always wondered that since the whole art is sort of hopeless, trying to get inside a person's head and what goes on 24/7 for 80 years, might you not bring more to a biography if you have the courage and the talent to write the story in an expressionistic or an impressionistic way that conveys poetry and conveys imagery that, that the standard narrative doesn't? And you've probably read more biographies or books about biography. Why is it that there is like this resistance? Like, well, I remember Edmund Morris when he did Dutch, for example,
well,
was castigated.
That certainly is a concern. And it's often people who attack biographies, say, oh, biographers, you know, they weren't there, they didn't know, and et cetera. You could say that about historians too, of course.
Yep.
But the point is, there is no 100% in knowing someone's life. I can't walk around myself.
Right.
I can't see myself in ways that you can see me and that other people will comment on. And that's just as valuable. We think of ourselves as, you know, created selves, but part of the creation is what other people think of us.
True.
And the implications of our actions. And that's what biographers are doing, and that's why biographers can sometimes know someone even better than their that subject's closest friend, wife, because you're taking this kaleidoscopic view. You know, it's a kind of privilege as a biographer. And so to narrow biography down to, well, he can't know what's going on in his mind. Well, look at memoir. Do memoirists know their minds any better than anybody else? Look at all the stuff they make up.
Yeah, I know.
And
fiction.
Right, fiction. So to give biographers a hard time about that, you know, as I get older, I get less and less patient with that argument.
Have you ever gotten halfway into a book or the research for a book and just decided, no, this person is despicable or doesn't interest me or boring or I can't bring anything to it and drop the subject?
That's never happened.
Okay.
Many of my subjects have been difficult subjects for all kinds of reasons, both in terms of personality, but sometimes their resistance to my doing a biography of them.
Yes, the famous war with Sontag.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And that doesn't trouble me. The only time that I began a biography, wrote a proposal, actually had a contract, and then canceled the contract, was after my Faulkner biography. I was given the opportunity to write a biography of Melville. And I had done this huge two-volume biography of Faulkner. And I was coming full circle because that was my dissertation. I had been reading and thinking about Faulkner for more than 50 years. And I'm excited by Melville. My wife and I did a reference book on Melville called Melville A to Z. So I was very keen on the subject. But when I started to really think about it, there wasn't enough gas in the tank.
Uh-huh.
I knew I'd have to do justice to Melville's work. It's an incredible body of work. I was entranced with his life in New York. I would have given readers a picture of him walking every day to work down to the docks. This guy who had written Moby Dick and never getting a raise in that job. And the fortitude, really the courage of someone to persist. You know, people had almost completely forgotten Melville by the end of his life. It was only until his revival in the 20s that people like Faulkner began to read him and were influenced by him. And I thought, what a tremendous story. And there are a lot of Melville biographies, of course. And every once in a while I go back to it and I think, gee, you know, it's a huge thing.
Yeah. Maybe a biographical essay.
Possibly.
Yeah. You talked about revisionism and... we are in the midst of a gigantic reappraisal of how we evaluate human beings, great human beings, like Jefferson, the slave owner who wrote all men are created equal. Paul Simon said every generation puts a hero up on the pop charts. And so is this good? Is this a fad that we should just sort of not worry about because this too shall pass? Or are we always going to be going back to the great people of the past, whether it's Cleopatra or Jefferson or whoever, and reinterpreting them through the eyes of what we've learned or what's happening to us right now in our time?
Yeah, I think we will. I think that would be my answer. I think we will continue to go back to those great figures. People get upset, you know. They take a historical figure's name off a building.
Yeah.
And people say, you're erasing history. You're not. I do think that people think that, for instance, the attacks on Jefferson and slavery and so on, there's a presentism involved, that we're judging him by standards that didn't apply in his day. Actually, they did. There are plenty of people that criticized Jefferson, the Founding Fathers. Mm-hmm. Gouverneur Morris at the Constitutional Convention said, what is this business about three-fifths of a person? You know, that's malarkey. Uh-oh. You can't do that. Well, they did it, of course. It was a crass political compromise. I'm doing a book called Making the American Presidency, How Biographers Shape History. I haven't written the chapter yet, but I'm going to do a chapter on Jefferson. And I'm not going to talk about his biographies. Yeah, yeah. I'm really going to focus on Sally Hemings. Uh-huh. When does she come in the story? Why does she come in then and not sooner? People did know about her in Jefferson's own time, but most biographers didn't take her seriously until Annette Gordon Reed.
Right.
And you know, by the way, there's now quite a reaction against Annette Gordon Reed.
I know.
There's a whole industry about
Phooey.
That. Yeah. But I'm going to get into all that. Yeah, it fascinates me.
But I think, you know, I've talked to her about this, and it's really true. The great fact about Sally Hemings is that she was actually the stepsister of Jefferson's
yes.
first wife, who yeah. he adored and who had died. And it's, if you can look at him, it's just a rapist and a manipulator. Or you can look at him as somebody who his wife walked through the door again alive and he was totally besotted, but the conventions of the time.
Yeah, there's that.
But you're right. He knew.
Yeah.
It wasn't just people were telling him. In his own writing, he's, you know, I know this.
This Madison knew it. Jefferson knew it.
Yeah. The big trend in biography, and it's almost past now, but for a period in the 40s and the 50s, biographies were written by the Academy.
Yes.
And great people like Alan Nevins brought style and dash to them. But I guess the last major biographer that we have operating now with a PhD is Doris Kearns Goodwin. And instead you have people like Caro and Cherno, who have sort of walked into a vacuum left by academic writers who are now focusing on different elements and also different themes and different peoples who have been forgotten in the past. As you've looked at biography and seen this happening, have you heard the complaints of the academics that these guys are getting all the attention? And
oh yeah,
yeah.
There's tremendous vitriol. Like Robert Carroll would have no standing in the academy whatsoever. You know, the discipline-oriented nature of academic study. Fred Carl, the late Fred Carl, is a friend of mine, and he once advised people, he said, if you're going to go into academic life, if you're, you know, literary criticism, do literary criticism. That's what I did. Before you do biography, establish your reputation as a critic first, and maybe your colleagues will tolerate you. I've had academic colleagues say to me, right to my face, that's interesting biography, but it's not scholarship.
Right. You have maintained a close contact with the world at large through your column and your podcast. Do you talk to young biographers, and do you have impressions about the next generation, how they're approaching biography, and do you have advice for them?
Because I have my own podcast, I do get people who write to me and say, I'm thinking of doing a biography. And just the other day, someone wrote to me and said, is it ethical to write about a living person without their permission? And I wrote back and said, you're asking me. I've got a book for you called Confessions of a Serial Biographer, which I deal with that whole issue. I said, it's not an issue with me.
Yeah.
But those kinds of things come up. You know, the whole term, this is, of course, one of my hobby horses, the idea of an authorized biography. It'd be like, what if someone said, I'm writing the authorized biography of the French Revolution? What the hell would that mean? What is this permission business about? It just seems, you know, so distorting.
What was the toughest book of yours to write?
Well, I knew the toughest one was going to be Susan Sontag, which, because she was alive, and I knew she would be hostile. My wife had and I had met her once in Poland. And because I knew it was going to be really difficult, it's the one biography I've written with someone else, namely my wife, Lisa Paddock, who is a lawyer. And in our book proposal, we said we are prepared. People often say if you're writing an unauthorized biography, if you're trying to get a contract, don't emphasize the complications. We did exactly that. We said this is going to be a really tough project, but we're prepared, and here's how we're prepared, and here's how we're going to do it. I read about that in a chapter in Confessions of a Serial Biographer, too. That was tough. And it's the one biography that continues to have repercussions in ways that have absolutely astonished me. I've had people attack me, and that's fine. They have a right to attack me. But
let the listener note that the person sitting across from me is like the least attackable person I could imagine on the planet.
Go ahead. It happens. What's incredible, I was reading in the galleys of Benjamin Moser's biography of Susan Sontag, people of Ferrer Strauss told him stories about how my wife and I had gone into Ferrer Strauss, the publisher house, and badgered Roger Strauss. If anyone knows Roger Strauss, they know this was impossible. This could not happen. To make a long story short, they made up these stories that Moser put into his book. And my wife, as a lawyer, wrote a lawyerly letter to the publisher and said, you better take this out, because this is not a he said, she said. We've never stepped foot in Ferrer Strauss. Mm-hmm. I've just been astonished that they won't let go. It's like a mob biography. And that sounds like an exaggeration.
Yeah.
But then I did a revised biography with my wife in 2015-16. At that point, Sontag's archive was open at UCLA, and there were all these letters from her friends saying things like, Rollison tried to interview me, and when I said no, he got all huffy. Well, for God's sakes, I would get huffy when I want someone to talk to me? I mean, it's just ridiculous that I would behave that way. And her own understanding, and I found this generally true in the literary world, with a few exceptions like Norman Mailer, Sontag knew absolutely nothing about biography. Her view was so unsophisticated, so pitifully simplistic. And I know this from reading her archive at UCLA. And she would say things like, oh, there's this guy, Rollison, out there. He's written about Muhammad Ali. I've never written about Muhammad. I mean, her basic facts were wrong. The one biography that I've done that is really, it's not the only one that's been criticized, obviously, but it's the one where I just can't believe how a biography that was first published in 2000 and then republished in 2017 still continues this kind of campaign by certain people.
What's that like to do a revision of a book that you've already done, and all of a sudden the subject dies, or for some other reason a huge archive becomes available?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I can't believe I missed this.
Well, I didn't miss it because it wasn't available.
Yeah.
It wasn't accessible, not to us, but to anybody at the time. It was still Sontag's private possession. I had a back channel. I had this scholar who was doing a bibliography who would visit her and tell me about things to look forward to.
Yeah.
And then when I went to UCLA, what really surprised me is not so much, there was some Annie Leibovitz stuff and other people that she was associated with, but what really hit home, and it's in the revised biography that wasn't in the original biography because we didn't have access to it, is the number of men who are absolutely gaga about Susan Sontag. People like Philip Dick, who would write these just mash letters, fan letters to her, very sophisticated literary critics, who just went silly over Sontag.
Yeah,
Right. And our original book was called The Making of an Icon, and the revision is too. And the initial reviews of The Making of an Icon, this again tells you something about the literary establishment, said, oh, really? They're just making this up or something. There was such a resistance You know, that if we talk about the making of icon, that must mean somehow we're just salacious and we're not interested in her work. Well, there's plenty about her work in the biography, but you don't get to be Marilyn Monroe or Susan Sontag by just passively asking the world to come to you.
Yeah.
And one of the things I found out in the original edition of our biography at the New York Public Library, the Ferrer Strauss archives were there, was a very funny letter from Robert Giroux, who had attended a Penn meeting in which Susan Sontag spoke, and she talked about how writing her first novel, The Benefactor, was she didn't know anybody in New York. Not true. She was going to parties, she was schmoozing, she was doing all these things. And she just treated herself like a neophyte writer who walked in one day to Ferrer Strauss, plopped this novel down on the desk, and hoped that somebody would read it. This is the story she told to this Penn group, and Robert Giroux was there. And Giroux wrote this sort of tongue-in-cheek letter to her. Susan, don't you remember what you actually did? You know, he didn't use the word actually. Yeah. I would use the word actually. What she actually had done was marched into Ferrer Strauss and said, Jason Epstein thinks that you should read this. You know, she immediately dropped a name that would catch people's attention. You know, just completely, you know, it was the way she presented it was like a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And this is what biography, see, this is why the nastiness comes out when you reveal these things about the way someone really did become Susan Sontag. Yeah. Then it just, oh boy, very upsetting.
What's the technical way of getting a revision? Do you go back to the original publisher and say, I'd like some more money and I want you to take
plates? Well, that's what we tried to do. The original biography is published by W.W. Norton. But the problem with the biography was Norton, I think they were the only publishing trade house in New York that would have published the book because they were independent. They didn't have a conglomerate to answer to. And we had a brave editor, Jerry Howard, who was not fazed by the Sontag mob and supported us. And I guess what I would say about the Sontag biography is that we knew what we were getting into, and we knew the kind of person we were dealing with. And so when it came to a revision of the biography, it was like value added.
Yeah.
For instance, there are a few pages where we're in the book, in the revised book, simply because we became part of her story.
Yeah.
The way she reacted to us does tell the reader something about what Sontag was like in New York and what her reputation was and why people were afraid of her and so on, which we knew before, but now we had additional archival evidence to say anybody would have faced the same problems we had faced, I guess is what I want to say.
Yeah. Do you, in choosing a subject, look at the amount of archival material or folks who are still alive and can talk about them, or is it the process the other way around, which is that you just pick somebody and hope that there's the resources there?
It's the latter. Okay. Lots of biographers say, well, I wouldn't do that because there's no archive or there's no letters or so on. I'm just the opposite. A very quick story. I was editor of the Hollywood Legends series, University Press of Mississippi. There was a very famous actor, most people probably don't know, recognize the name now, Dana Andrews, who's a big star in the 1940s. And has a huge following on Facebook, for example, and other places. I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know anything at the time except that the film that made him a star, Laura, was my favorite movie. And it's about a plainclothes detective, which is what my father was. Uh-huh. So there were a lot of things about it. But it never occurred to me to do a biography of Dean Andrews. And then the head of University Press of Mississippi called me one day, and she said, do you know anybody who might want to do a biography of Dana Andrews? And at the time, I was writing a biography of Amy Lowell. And she said, do you know anybody? Immediately, I said, yes. And she said,
because Amy Lowell is so close to Dana Andrews.
Right, exactly. So I said, me. I didn't know if there was going to be an archive, what the family's attitude was going to be, all the things that most biographers think about first before they commit themselves. But I was in. It didn't occur to me until it occurred to me, and then there was no going back. It didn't matter. And there are reasons why I learned after the Marilyn Monroe biography why that was the way for me to work.
Well, I would love to spend 30 minutes with you just talking about Gellhorn or Hellman, or definitely we're going to talk about presidents when you get further down the line.
We will.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Well, That was veteran author Carl Roileson talking with John A. Farrell about his latest book, Sylvia Plath, Day by Day, Volume 2. It was published by the University Press of Mississippi in August of this year. We recorded this interview in May 2024 at BIO's annual conference in New York City. To learn more about BIO or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Alani Hodge created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a fantastic day.